All right. I'm Scott. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. Holy crap! Man, I just got some good news! I'm sitting here typing back and forth. It's really bad timing for the start of a radio show. But my buddy, he got the job! A really good job. You know, what's funny about him is he had a really lousy job. And then he was really happy that he got this job that was pretty good. And he's saying, man, I got this pretty good job. But now, this job that he got makes his pretty good job look like nothing. Cool. Well, you know, that's the thing. If you're a genius, you ought to also be able to find a way to market that genius. So that's what you get. I guess wait around, figure it out, get it done. Congratulations to you, dude. That's good, if you're listening. That's cool. Isn't that nice? Somebody, while everyone else is getting laid off, one of us got a job. That's pretty good. All right, today is the 2nd of April, 2014. Isn't that weird? 2014 already. Like, you think about what 84 was to the 80s, what 94 was to the 90s. That's what we are to the teens already. Isn't that weird? Weird, man. Can't believe 2004 was that long ago. Boy, I'll never forget 2004. Jeez. Or 94 or 84, for that matter. See, I was in second grade, and I remember coming back from Christmas break, and January the whatever, 1984, was written on the blackboard. 1984, huh? Is that Amino Domini? What's that again, teach? That's how old I am. Pretty old. Or that's how young I am, pretty young, depending on how old or young you are, I suppose. Theory of relativity and all that, you know. All right, well, whatever. So, hey, listen, man, dang on, Phil Giraldi's going to be on the show, and I'm going to ask him about a bunch of things, because he knows a bunch of stuff. One of the things we're going to talk about is Jonathan Pollard, again. That's Phil's new article for the American Conservative. No, it's not, for uns.com. And then also, maybe we'll talk about Palestine, maybe we'll talk about Turkey. You know, Phil, back when he was a CIA guy, used to be stationed in Turkey, knows a lot about it. And there's a lot of going on over there, so we'll be talking about that with him. And also NATO, we could talk all about expanding eastward to Russia's border and all the buildup. We're going to talk about that with or without Phil on the show today, all the buildup in Eastern Europe. Man, I can't stand to see these politicians running things. I know people are afraid. You bring up the idea, I mean, think how fanciful it sounds like, right? The idea of having no state. But boy, you compare that to the world empire we live under right here, right now. There's no contest. There is nothing about having no government that could possibly be more dangerous than having this government. I mean, the closest thing they have to a grand strategy is whatever Bill Kristol thinks. And they're willing to risk nuclear war over what Bill Kristol thinks. If you're not familiar, maybe you're a youngin' or you just started caring about politics or something. That's the gold standard of stupid, Bill Kristol. Know nothing, know it all. Israel Firster. Scumbag. Head of PNAC and editor of the Weekly Standard. Founder of the Foreign Policy Initiative and the Emergency Committee for Israel. And probably 10 or 15 more of these, letterhead think tanks. Anyway. So, Phil will be on the show. No friend of the neocons. We'll be talking with him about all of that stuff, or at least some of it. And then also, I got plenty to talk about myself, too. You know what? First thing I wanted to say was about, and this is just because I have little time before the first break on the show today, right? So I might as well just kind of fill this time frame up with my throwaways for you here. Campaign finance reform. Big debate going on TV. Oh, I guess maybe in some courts or something here. They're talking about it on Fox again. It's, yeah, I'm watching Fox today because I just can't stand the damn missing plane anymore. They're talking about it right now. Oh, there's a ruling, a campaign finance ruling. And anyway, here's all I got to say about that. As long as we're stuck having elections, we ought to have a consensus that the people elected in those elections have no say over who can finance what, other than maybe, I guess, keeping foreign money out. Remember what a big scandal they used to pretend they cared when Bill Clinton got all that money from the Chinese for his re-election of, 1984 for governor. And then, or was it 86 or whatever? Yeah. And then 92 and 96, 88. Wait, yeah, 92 and 96. Anyway, they don't really care about that so much anymore. Well, the trick is dual citizenship. That'll get you by. That's like, squeezing under the limbo bar. But otherwise, as anyone who thinks about it for a second ought to be able to figure out for you, all the campaign finance laws are made by the incumbents to keep you out. They'll let Sheldon Adelson or Adelson or however you say it, they'll let the guys over at Citigroup, they can bankroll the party, they can bankroll the super PACs and the non-super PACs and the this kind of PACs and the those kind of PACs and the TV ads and whatever they want. They can hire armies of lawyers to make sure that they can get it done just right. But if the people of your county are sick and tired of this scumbag who claims to be your representative and you want to, you know, do harm to him with some TV ads, oh no. Sorry, you're banned. And this is just one example. There's got to be a million of them. You're banned from running TV ads within 60 days of an election. You know, when it matters at all. And so, of course, it's just, you know, I mean, look at this. McCain-Feingold is what they call it, right? So, malevolence and ignorance teamed up. And what did they do? All they did was pass the Incumbent Protection Act. And, of course, when George Bush signed it, at the signing ceremony, he admitted, I know that this is unconstitutional. But I'm going to sign it anyway because I expect the Supreme Court to strike it down. What? And then the part that the Supreme Court finally did strike down was that there can be any limit on what the billionaires can do. But the ban on regular people being able to put their money together to run a few TV ads, to try to resist the people already in power, that all remains a crime. Or at least it remains so heavily regulated that regular people just can't do it. They can't afford the legal fees and putting it together right and making sure that everything is done in a way that'll keep them out of prison. Because, of course, you know, the laws applies to those who would challenge power, not those who wield it. There's no rule of law. That's all just a silly myth, of course. And do whatever they want. The people with the power can. And so, you know, I know people have this idealized thing where democracy is perfectly fair. I see people going around saying, you're a damn fool if you don't support public financing of elections. Well, how's that right? To force Republicans to finance the campaigns of Democrats and vice versa. And what about all the libertarians? Libertarians and independents, they've got to all be forced to finance their opponents who outmatch them in every way in terms of the power and money already accumulated? It's a rigged game. Of course it's a rigged game. And, of course, money is speech. Glenn Greenwald did the perfect hypothetical. Oh, really? Do you think it would be okay for a Republican state government to outlaw donating to the ACLU? Right. Because money is speech. Exactly. That's what I thought. Don't be an idiot. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. And, yeah. Anyway, that's my thing about campaign finance. I don't care about that anymore. All right, let me say real quick here about General Motors and these switches. Look, I haven't paid that much attention to this, but I read a little bit about it a few weeks back, I guess. Where they talked about how they had reasoned, I guess this was in the paperwork, they had reasoned at General Motors that, well, you know, even if the ignition turns off, you can still steer and use the brakes, pretty much. So, therefore, it goes in the category of, things we might like to fix if we ever get around to it instead of anything important. It was like a government bureaucracy or something. Once it got funneled into that tranche of paperwork, there it stayed. And so they didn't care, even while people and people's kids were dying. I don't mean to say that kids aren't people, but I'm just trying to drive home the very realness of the people to you, you know. Getting them killed. Yeah, you know, if you're driving in the 21st century, if you're driving your General Motors automobile down the road, it might just shut off and kill you. Get you killed. And as one of these news readers actually mentioned on TV earlier, part of the scandal here, although, of course, according to TV, the least part of the scandal, is how the regulators completely failed to prevent this from happening. Well, how could that be? In fact, they didn't even put it that way at all. What they said was, GM, they even got around the regulators. Those giants of virtue and capability. Somehow GM evaded their brilliance, benevolence, and authority to make things right. It's a real mystery. We need to have, according to the new Joe Lieberman, Kelly Ayotte, she says, well, we need to have a joint select committee on this. Oh, no, maybe she was talking about Benghazi. That was another thing she was saying. We'll get to that in a second. But anyway, oh, it's such a big deal. Oh, everybody cares so much about this and wonders how this could happen. And I would just like to point out that General Motors could have gone out of business and ceased to exist and could have been taken over by an entirely, all their actual assets could have been taken over by entirely new companies. Back in 2008 and 9. But the American people allowed their government to go and bail GM out and keep them in business and keep them killing people for money. And then, of course, the other easy, too easy to point out point is, of course, that the regulatory state was invented by conservative big business to protect them from the forces of the marketplace. It was never the case that, oh, yeah, sure, the rich capitalists, they rule everything in the market. And if you want a free market, then you're saying the very rich capitalists just get to do whatever they want. And that's why we need regulation to temper their unlimited authority in the marketplace. That was always a big, stupid, stinking lie. Give me a break. Haven't you ever read Gabriel Kolko? The Triumph of Conservatism? It was the conservatives that invented progressivism. The regulatory state controlled by the democracy to help the people. Yeah, that and a bunch of other fairy tales I read when I was a kid, too. The regulatory state is there to prop up people who have already succeeded, to protect them from competition. This whole theory of regulatory capture is the name of the game in the first place. That's why they created the national government in the first place. Regulatory capture, to boil it down. As John Adams put it, you can go read all the letters back and forth between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, and Adams explaining explicitly that the theory behind the Constitution, Thomas, is that the state will prop up those who are the most well-born and protect their role in society, and they will in turn protect the permanence of the state. You know, fascism. That's what it's all about. That's what it's always been about. And, you know, so-called democratic reforms of expanding government power is always just nothing but Br'er Rabbit crying, "Don't throw me in the briar patch." Speaking of stories for little kids. "Oh, no, please don't regulate me," cries John Rockefeller and J.P. Morgan. "How will I ever influence what kind of laws and regulations the government passes and implements?" they gasped. Wait, right? Does that make sense at all? Here's one to make it real easy. As soon as the Justice Department started suing Microsoft under the antitrust laws, because of Internet Explorer wasn't fair to Netscape, remember that? Right? Because no one will ever be able to invent Opera and Mozilla and Chrome and anything else to compete with Internet Explorer. But oh, it's gangsterism. It's monopolism. Only the government can stop us from Microsoft forcing us to use their crappy browser, the government cried. And only then, for the first time, did Microsoft invest a substantial amount of money in one of the most powerful lobbying firms in Washington, D.C., to take care of their regulatory business. I mean, they already had salesmen in D.C. selling, you know, computer software to the state all the time. But how can Microsoft really gangsterize the software market? Well, they didn't even really think of it till the government came for them first. And then they decided, oh, what we need is to hire the most powerful lobbying firm that there is to make sure that our interests are protected. And then it was the next day they started abusing it. Come on. You think they were abusing their power trying to force you to use their crappy browser? You know, God knows what kind of rules and regulations that they've introduced to limit their competition and provide, you know, rent-seeking tax benefits for themselves. Taxpayer-provided benefits. I don't complain about tax cuts. Those are fine. I mean, other people's money taken, extorted, and handed to Microsoft by the government ever since they got in the regulate me game. As long as you're regulating me, I better be the one writing the regulations. Okay, good. I picked Microsoft because that's a relatively new company, right? Invented in the freaking 1980s. But how to make sure they're permanent? It didn't just compete and win in the market. And it isn't just be an incredibly shrewd businessman, you know, screwing IBM every which way and whatever the way Bill Gates became successful. Nope, you're going to have to buy some congressmen and senators. Luckily, they come pretty cheap. But anyway, there you go. So, you know, will General Motors kill your family for money? Of course they will. Just the same as the local city council will shorten a yellow light and drive your family out in front of an oncoming truck and get them killed if they can make a little bit of extra red light revenue with their new camera that they got. Of course they'll kill you for money. They're businessmen and politicians. But the question is, so how do you limit that? And the answer is, you've got to privatize the checks and balances. You need more and more severe checks and balances. And, of course, you know, the reason that the media won't touch stuff like this anymore before it gets to this point is because the media faked it before. Remember Jane Pauley and was it Stone Phillips, and they faked the GM or Ford pickup trucks, that they planted explosives in the truck and said, oh, but if you T-bone it, it'll explode. But they faked it. And ever since then, oh boy, they don't mess around. Coming up next, wife killed her husband. True crime stories some more. That's what every TV news magazine show became. Nothing but true crime crap after they framed up GM. But of course, the only reason that that's a problem, or was a problem especially then, less so now, is because of the virtual monopoly of ABC, CBS, and NBC, and of course, the monopoly of the American court system, which after screwing NBC that hard on that one, for what they really did, set the precedent for just how powerful these corporations can be when it comes to attacking journalists who expose their work. So again, it's the government getting in the way of what would be a free press in a free society. It doesn't require a government to protect them at all. And, you know, you just look at Underwriters Laboratories and Consumer Reports and Good Housekeeping Seals of Approval and all these things. All you need is that same kind of, market appraisal. And in a free market, you wouldn't even, no one has to juice it up other than the customers. They have to demand some serious quality inspections and some serious fighting. And it's got to be the case that journalists are there so that if Underwriters Laboratories ever gets too corrupt, I don't even know if they check cars. I'm just making this up, using them as an example. If they get corrupt and get bribed by GM to look the other way on an ignition thing like this, there's got to be 10 more just like them competing for the reputation of most willing and best capable of serving the consumer rather than the corporations that they're checking. And you just can't get that kind of check and balance with government ever, no matter what they do. The ultimate example, of course, is the 9/11 attack happening on George W. Bush's watch, on his government's watch, his head of the CIA, his Secretary of Defense, his National Security Advisor, his National Security Council. Their approval rating went up to 90% after the greatest failure of an American politician and group of his staff ever. Because there's nowhere else to go. There's no other security force to hire. They're all we got. And everybody, of course, rallied around them because, oh, foreign enemy, foreign attack. We all have to show that we support our leader and all of this crap. Whereas any private security firm that was standing around and got attacked like that, real ass Al-Qaeda in the country for a year and a half. And these guys couldn't stop it. They'd been in power for 9 months and they couldn't stop it. Whoever has had a job where you weren't expected to start doing your job for 9 months. And yet their approval rating goes up because they've got a monopoly. They do a lousy job because they've got a monopoly, first and foremost. And that's the same thing with the regulators, and that's the same thing pretty much with General Motors. I mean, they've got a triopoly in America anyway. I don't know why anyone will buy an American vehicle anyway at this point. You're crazy. I guess I'm stupid enough too. I have a Dodge truck. But if I could afford it, I'd be driving a Nissan. Well, actually, my truck is a Nissan. The wife's truck is a Dodge. Oh, man, I'm supposed to be playing ads for you here. Ads. Get a Nissan. They don't die on you on the highway like a General Motors truck. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfi, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, well, I just tweeted it, and it's true. Got Philip Giraldi on the show today, former CIA and DIA officer, executive director of the Council for the National Interest, and writer for UNS.com and TheAmericanConservative.com, and author of this piece about Jonathan Pollard, the top of my Jonathan Pollard section that I have here in my tabs today. Jonathan Pollard, again, why he must complete his time in prison at UNS.com. Welcome back to the show, Phil. How are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you, Scott?
I'm doing good. Appreciate you joining us here today. And I've been reading up on Pollard. I went and found it's at freerepublic.com. Why Pollard Should Never Be Released, The Traitor, by Seymour Hersh. And then there's a new one at MSNBC by Daphna Linzer, a little bit of the background of the Pollard case. And, of course, actually the most I know about this, other than your article here, is what I learned in the speech by Spike Bowman at the National Summit to Reassess the American-Israel Special Relationship that you and Grant Smith and others held there in Washington, D.C. a few weeks back. And Spike Bowman, correct me if I'm wrong, he was the FBI counterintelligence officer who put together the case against Jonathan Pollard primarily, correct?
That's right. He was the coordinator of what they call the damage assessment, which basically assessed the extent to which Pollard had done major damage to U.S. security. And then he was also the person that worked directly with Casper Weinberger to make up a case on paper that would pull all this information together.
Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, Casper Weinberger being the Secretary of Defense at the time, and then that was the that was the paper that the judge cited at sentencing, correct?
That's correct, yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right, and now, so give us a little bit of background here, could you? Who's Jonathan Pollard? What'd he do? When did he get in trouble for it and all that for the newbies?
Well, the Pollard case basically was carried out on behalf of Israel. Pollard was not an ideologue when he started. He essentially wanted money, and he had approached a number of countries, including Africa, to sell intelligence. And so it's actually somewhere down the road for him. But once
now, pay attention to the pay no attention to the spy on the line, Phil. But you keep getting muted out every once in a while here. Is that your call waiting, or is that the Israelis intercepted between here and Virginia?
Yeah, I didn't see anything come up, but, you know, you never know. FBI is active in this area. But anyway, so Pollard was, who now claims to have been a patriotic Israeli, in effect, never started out that way. And this is a point that Spike Bowman made, that Pollard was in it for the money, and he would have sold it to anybody. He's never really expressed any remorse. He's always claimed he didn't really do any damage at all. And his supporters essentially come out with the argument, well, gee, he was spying to help an ally, and he was only giving them information that was useful for them, for their own security, and that they should have had. Now, Bowman went through the steps, and, of course, if you go online, you can pull up more details on this to demonstrate that all these characterizations of Pollard are wrong. They're basically made up to make a case for the guy. The guy was an out-and-out criminal. He stole more information than any spy in American history, a whole room full of highly classified information, and some of it was extremely sensitive in that it would have given the Russians, Soviets at that time, an edge in their own intelligence collection to acquire this information. And there are many in the intelligence community who believe that the Israelis did indeed pass some of this information on to the Soviets.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. How much of this information and at what level? And then I guess, was it just they had to assume that, and so then they had to act as if they must have given it over to the Soviets, or they really had strong indication that the Israelis were turning around and laundering this information, turning it over to the Reds, and for what purpose? Why would they betray America like that, Phil?
Yeah, well, they had indications of this, and of course, when you do a damage assessment, you make a worst case assessment because you have to assume that your worst nightmares are going to take place. Now, what happened in this case was that there was evidence that the Israelis were trading intelligence that they obtained from Pollard for the Soviets in turn to release Russian Jews and let them emigrate, which was a big issue at that time. And people, including at that time, William Casey, who was the director of CIA, believed that there was a direct connection on all this stuff and that the Israelis had indeed traded some of this information. What the evidence is going beyond that, I don't know. But apparently that was widely believed in the intelligence community and was even something that we talked about in the field where I was, that this intelligence had not only been stolen, but had been given to the enemies of the United States.
All right. Now, in the Hirsch piece, which was written, I think, in 1999, around the time that Bill Clinton was considering releasing Jonathan Pollard and had to back down because George Tenet and the leadership of the CIA and I guess some other intelligence agencies were threatening to resign over it. But in that Hirsch piece, he talks about, I think it's the book is called Raisin, and this is, for some reason, the NSA, at least at that time, kept one big book, or obviously there's a lot of different notebooks, but kept it kind of all together, and this was sort of the master list of everything that they'd tapped and how they tapped it, right? Like the Snowden revelations, all the stuff that he gave Greenwald that's never going to be published, right? It's going to be is the stuff that this guy, Pollard, was handing over to a foreign government.
Yeah, like this, if you compiled a book of the most sensitive information that exists in the U.S. intelligence community, that's essentially what Pollard handed over. It was a technical manual that told you what the U.S. capabilities were to intercept Russian communications, for example, Soviet communications at that time, and it also assessed the Soviet communications. So if the Soviets had a copy of the book, they'd be able to impossible.
I'm sorry. If the Soviets had a copy of the book, what?
They would tweak their system to make it impossible for the United States to access their communications more, and they would also be able to attack U.S. communications. So it was very sensitive information.
I wonder if the listeners are getting the same idea as me, that your statements are being redacted in real time here, Phil. The way you keep
going
mute
on
us.
Because I just checked my phone and it's not doing anything. So, I mean, I don't know where that beeping is coming from. It's a mystery.
Yeah, pay no attention. It's not a big deal. Everybody, nothing to see here. All right, yeah. And then, so now, before we talk about the current politics of this, which are just absolutely incredible, by the way, can you take us back to 1999 and the controversy over, Clinton's the Y River Accord and this and that and the negotiations when they almost let him go before and what happened?
Well, that was a typical Clinton. I mean, Clinton, you know, if you go back and you study the politics. Oh, God, what's going on with these phones? Scott, it's my wife. I've got to take it. It's probably an emergency.
Okay, go ahead. I'll fill in here.
Just hang on.
Sure. All right, we'll tune back in to Phil here in just a minute, guys. No problem at all. This is a big deal, and this is in the Hirsch piece. Again, you can find it at freerepublic.com. Why Pollard Should Never Be Released, The Traitor, by Cy Hirsch. And he goes into a lot of detail about, a lot of what's known about this case. But then at the end, he talks about the controversy where George Tenet, of all worms, can you imagine that he would take a stand over anything? George Tenet apparently threatened to lead a mass resignation of American intelligence officials over this. You know, one thing I was meaning to ask Phil about there, and maybe I'll remember to ask him again, is, you know, I'm kind of used to a lot of hyperbole from the last year, especially from the intelligence community about, for example, the Snowden leaks, especially, but from before that, the Manning leaks and how much damage all this is. And I guess, you know, if I can remember too, when I hit the button here, if he's there, I'll ask him, when to take him seriously and when not. Is it just when the spy's working for Israel instead of the Guardian? I don't know. Let's see. Hey, Phil, you there?
Yeah, I'm here, Scott. My daughter is having a baby.
Oh, really? That's great.
That's what the phone calls were.
So I should let you go, right? Because you got to head out the door or what?
Yeah, I'm going to be heading out the door. But anyway, let me answer your question before I go.
Okay.
Clinton, as Gareth Porter proved in his book, which you probably know as well as I do, Clinton was the one who shifted U.S. policy vis-a-vis Iran and vis-a-vis the world to the Israeli model, to what Israel was wanting. And part of this was essentially turned out to be that Clinton figured, hey, it would be a nice gesture to Bibi Netanyahu to give him Pollard. And but what happened was, when as soon as he raised the issue, of course, everybody went crazy in the intelligence community, because you got to realize what years we're talking about. This was still a pretty recent event in terms of government. And anyway, everybody rebelled about it. Clinton was prepared to let him go, but he had to back down.
Right. All right. Well, I'll let you go. Go take care of your family and have a good time, Phil.
Okay. Right. Bye-bye.
See ya. Oh, man. Isn't that great? Today's just a good news kind of a show. All right. So now more bad news. So the thing is Obama's going to let him go now. Guys, at least that's what trial balloons all over the place. They're seeing whether people put up with it. And for what? You know, I saw only the tail end of the discussion last night on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. They had Aaron David Miller on there, and he was summing up the case. What they're leaking so far is, if they release Jonathan Pollard, the guy who turned over, you know, more secrets to the Reds even than Robert Hansen or Aldrich Ames or John Walker, if they turn over Pollard to the Israelis, then the Israelis might let some women and children out of prison that they've got no right holding in the first place, that they can just turn around and arrest 10 times as many the day after tomorrow anyway. And then, what, that's it? And then maybe promise to extend the talks toward the having of talks? In other words, Obama is prepared to give up Jonathan Pollard in exchange for nothing. In exchange for nothing. And you know, this is something that I'm afraid I did not get a chance to go over specifically at the end of the Gareth Porter series of interviews there. But one of the things that he wrote about is about how in 2009, when Obama came in and started acting friendly toward the Iranians, that the reason he backed off on that and decided to scotch all the negotiations of 2009 was a compromise with Netanyahu that he would promise to freeze the settlements in the Palestinian territories. And Obama fell for that. The freeze that, as we all know, amounted to absolutely nothing in practice. Now they're going to do it again. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Well, that was Grandpa Giraldi there. On his way off to the hospital where he's having another grandkid. That's cool. All right. That's all right. You know what? I can complain about the news all by myself without help from nobody. The only reason that this ever was an interview show is just to trick y'all into listening to me anyway. You picked up on that, right? So, I don't know. You can tune out now if you want. There ain't going to be no more interviews today. I don't think. You know, I didn't get to ask Phil. What about Mega? Who's Mega? Was it Henry Kissinger? Was it George H.W. Bush? Who's Mega? I want to know. All right, I don't know. Yeah. No, I think H.W. Bush was more of a Nazi than a Zionist. His son is much more in the Zionist camp. Skips a generation. Not. Anyway. No, Prescott, he was a Nazi too. All right. Yeah, I'm Scott. This is my show. And here's something funny. Is this really true, or was this... I should double-check my source before I say this out loud, man. Oh, no, was that Mondo Weiss? I guess it could have been. It could have been an April Fool's joke, but I don't think so. It's ridiculous like an April Fool's joke. Where the hell is it? Where the hell is it? In Philly. Oh, come on, Phil. Is this really true? Philip Weiss, everybody. In Philadelphia, right-wing Zionists... Boy, is my mic up too loud? I'm sorry about your ear holes there. I ain't trying to hurt you. In Philly, right-wing Zionists called Dershowitz anti-Semitic for opposing settlements. Damn it. You know, I never can read through the punchline without laughing. I am the worst. That's like my second or fourth worst character flaw. I can just never tell a damn joke without ruining it by laughing. No, really, that's the headline. That's the joke, is that I'm not joking. This is really what it says. Dershowitz. Well, if you're not familiar, Alan Dershowitz, when he's not defending the Fourth Amendment in ancient times, he's arguing for the repeal of the Fifth and Eighth Amendments in modern times, and for whatever Israel's government is doing wrong always, and against the character of anyone who dares to disagree. He's a real scumbag, Alan Dershowitz. But apparently, from a right-wing Zionist, Israeli nationalist, expansionist type of a point of view, he's got a character flaw. Where I guess some part of him is acquainted with the slightest bit of reason. And he questions whether it makes sense for the Israeli government to continue to allow, to promote, the settling of Israeli Jews in the occupied territories in the West Bank. And here he's being attacked. Dershowitz attempted to defend himself, comparing his assailants to Meir Kahane, and denounced their racism. But his appeals were barely audible. Whoops. Over the shouted crosstalk and frenzied cheers of the audience. If you don't want people like me defending Israel, he said, you're in serious trouble. This is amazing. I should rewind. I skipped too far ahead into the story, didn't I? I'm just going to read the whole damn thing. Matt Berkman has a great piece up at the Cairo Review of Global Affairs reporting on the screening last week in Philadelphia of a right-wing documentary, Attack on J Street, the liberal Zionist organization. Nearly 700 people went to the screening of the J Street Challenge at the University of Pennsylvania. Alan Dershowitz was the headliner. It was widely expected that the battle that night would be between liberal Zionists and right-wingers over the fact that Jewish community organizations, the Jewish Federation of Greater Philadelphia and the Hillel Foundation for Jewish Campus Life, were sponsoring an event trashing liberal Zionism. But as it turned out, the main attacks that night were on Dershowitz from the right because he opposes some settlements in the West Bank. Berkman writes that traditionally Zionist forces in U.S. life were able to sustain a coalition between right and left wings, epitomized by Dershowitz himself. But that old coalition is falling apart, and Dershowitz is now in a middle ground, assaulted by the right-wing donor base. And J Street may also be marooned in the middle, Berkman says, as young Jews abandon Zionism altogether. Some of his report from the screening. So this is now Mondo Weiss, Philip Weiss, block quoting Matt Berkman. The film in question, oh, and this is me block quoting the both of them out loud to you right now. The film in question, The J Street Challenge, is a slickly produced far-right assault on the pro-Israel, pro-peace organization. Produced by Americans for Peace and Tolerance, one of the growing number of right-wing Zionist groups with Orwellian names, the film mostly showcases the perspectives of hardcore Jewish ethno-nationalists. What transpired? The intermittent pandemonium and racist hysteria of the Q&A session, the evident tensions between Dershowitz and his co-panelist, presumably Charles Jacobs, and the fact that it all went down under the auspices of mainstream Jewish community groups, is the best evidence yet that an increasingly panicked and isolated right-wing donor base is waging a scorched earth campaign against the very foundations of contemporary American Zionism. Speaker after speaker stepped to the mic to lambast Dershowitz, often in the most abusive terms. Somebody's got to show me the video of this. In the most abusive terms, for a wide variety of crimes, for refusing the, for referring to the West Bank instead of, quote, Judea and Samaria. Oh, so now it's how dare you not call it Judea and Samaria. Okay, good. For Dershowitz's anti-Semitic denial of the right of Jews to colonize the Palestinian city of Hebron. For encouraging his followers to vote for the Jew-hater Barack Obama. And, of course, for his failure to comprehend the savage, homicidal nature of Islam. Dershowitz, this is where I picked up before. Dershowitz attempted to defend himself, comparing his assailants to Meir Kahane and denouncing their racism. But his appeals were barely audible over the shouted crosstalk and frenzied cheers of the audience. If you don't want people like me defending Israel, he told them, then you're in serious trouble. To anyone not hermetically ensconced in the far right... Boy, I'm messing up a lot today. To anyone not ensconced in the far right moral universe engineered by wealthy activists like Jacobs and billionaire Republican financier Sheldon Adelson, and few of the hundreds in attendance were not, the whole scene was insane. It was a topsy-turvy world where Alan Dershowitz and young AIPAC devotees represent the despised far-left wing of the official Jewish conversation about Israel. But this was not the meaning of some fringe group in a synagogue basement. It was a big Federation-sponsored production at a prestigious university. Young American Jews are getting off the pro-Israel bus, and the fury of the right-wing donor base, its uncalculated reaction to the sudden loss of control, is poised to further erode the historic bargain between Zionism and liberalism that kept the wheels in motion for so many years. As J Street members move further to the left and the Jewish world turns bimodal, pure universalism versus pure ethno-nationalism, we're likely to see more of these insurgent encroachments by the far right into mainstream spaces. With the Dershowitzian compromise on life support, the internal dynamics of Jewish institutional life are about to get very, very interesting. Isn't that interesting, man? I guess, you know, human beings, I like studying them. They're fun. Yeah, so there you go. Left and right and blowback and backlash and all of this. You can see how most American Jews, especially after World War II, even though they're liberals, and would tend to say, for example, disapprove of the near extermination of the American Indians, or at least, you know, regret it, they could justify the creation of the State of Israel at the expense of the Arabs, mostly by pretending that the Arabs weren't there, and then also just sort of saying, yeah, but what can you do? But then they always have had, you know, somewhere to go to the left without giving up on Israel. Well, you should just give up the West Bank. Stop the occupation, right? And then that way, they're not taking a right-wing Israel nationalist position. They're taking a much more moderate one, which I'm saying it is a much more moderate one than the status quo or worse. But at the end of the day, American Jews are liberals more than they're Zionists, especially the younger ones. And, you know, obviously that's a very broad brush statement. But it seems that as the situation in Israel necessitates either, further doubling down on their right-wing nationalist occupation, you know, conquering Lebensraum type strategy that they've implemented here. It's got to go further and further the other way, right? To give up the project now would be a huge switch back to the left. And so more and more the government of Israel goes right, and the Israeli government supporters in America turn right, and most American Jews drop out. Because at the end of the day, they're much more Jeffersonian than they are Kahanist, right? I think so. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all his stocks while the getting is good, investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the war state, available at scotthorton.org/Amazon. All right. God, dang, show's already half over. You believe that? I think maybe the show should be 3 hours. I don't know. Got other stuff to do, man. All right. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Thanks very much for listening. Here we're going to talk about Eastern Europe in a second. But I wanted to, as long as we're talking about Israel-Palestine here for a second, let me say a couple of things. First of all, please look at John Glazer's thing over here at antiwar.com/blog. John Kerry's unfair interim deal for Israel-Palestine. And, here's his bullet points. The Palestinians will agree to extend the negotiations for a year until 2015 and will refrain during this period from taking any unilateral actions at the UN. You know, like pressing war crimes charges at the International Criminal Court. They're really afraid. Because, you know, they commit war crimes all the time, so they don't get in trouble for that. The United States will free the spy Jonathan Pollard before Passover. Israel will initiate a fourth round. If you're just tuning in, we covered that in the previous segments there. Israel will initiate a fourth round of prisoner releases that will include 14 Israeli Arabs, Palestinian citizens of Israel. Israel will release 400 Palestinian prisoners who have no blood on their hands, that is, people who are innocent anyway and are due to be released anyway. And they'll freeze most construction except in East Jerusalem, and they'll use restraint in publishing building tenders and marketing land to contractors. Well, whatevers. I don't know what building tenders is, but sounds like stealing people's land and then building apartment complexes on top of it. Anyway, so what a joke. And the Palestinians are supposed to give in to this. And the Palestinians' answer was, President Mahmoud Abbas says the Palestinians are immediately resuming their bid to win further UN recognition and has signed applications for 15 UN agencies and conventions. In other words, he's threatening to go ahead and declare statehood anyway under the international system and force the rest of the international system to either accept or reject. And America and Israel are going to find themselves very isolated on this issue very quickly. Now, I was amazed. I got to tell you, honestly, to see Barack Obama as honest about this as he was, and he was smart to choose Jeffrey Goldberg to tell it to so that he can make it clear that, like, look, Jeffrey, you know I love you, man, but come on. I think that the current policy over there is mistaken. Let me just walk you through a thought experiment for you here a little bit about what happens if you don't give up the West Bank. Then pretty soon you at least de facto annex it. It becomes part of Israel proper, and then the Palestinian Christians and Muslims outnumber the Israeli Jews. And then, at that point, you can either have your Jewish state or your democracy, one or the other. And whichever way you choose, it's going to be problematic. It's already problematic trying to have both, but it's better than having one or the other. You're going to find yourself without support. And, you know, it's already wearing very thin, even here, even, you know, as we talked about in the last segment, among American Jews who have been part of the establishment and are dropping out of it. I mean, of the American, Israeli, whatever. The Israel support establishment in America, the Israel lobby in America, They just don't want anything to do with it anymore. What's for support? And then here's the other thing. And this really helps, I think, make the case. And I think it's important that it's by Peter Beinart, who, you know, he wrote a book a lot like what I'm talking about the choice that Israel faces. And he had this, you know, kind of liberal Zionist crisis of conscience that, you know, man, I think I'll give up my Zionism before my liberalism here, kind of a thing, even though he was really bad on the Iraq war and helped lie us into it, in fact, or at least push ridiculous lies in his writing. I think for mostly the New Republic and or the New Yorker, too. Think of the New Yorker. Anyway, but he's apologized for that, I think, sincerely. And anyway, Peter Beinart, he's written this article for Haaretz, the liberal daily in Tel Aviv, and it's called Sheldon Adelson's Culture of Hate. And here's what he says. Imagine this. Hillary Clinton, Andrew Cuomo, Elizabeth Warren, and multiple lesser Democratic notables travel halfway across the country to kiss the ring of a Palestinian-American billionaire who has shown himself willing to spend tens of millions of dollars subsidizing presidential campaigns. The billionaire has some provocative views. 6 months earlier, he suggested that if Israel does not stop its nuclear weapons program, America should drop an atomic weapon in the middle of the Negev desert so that it doesn't hurt a soul. If that doesn't work, America should drop the next one in the middle of Tel Aviv. The billionaire insists that there is no such thing as the Jewish people. It's a hoax. The Jews have fooled the world very successfully, and he declares that there isn't a Jew alive who wasn't raised on a curriculum of hatred and hostility toward the Palestinians. Change the words Democrat to Republican, Israel to Iran, and Palestinian to Jewish, and that's exactly what just happened. Leading contenders for the 2016 Republican presidential nomination spent last weekend wooing and feting a billionaire, Sheldon Adelson, whose views, if directed at Jews, would put him in the company of Louis Farrakhan and Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. I would say it would make him a hell of a lot worse than Farrakhan. I mean, Farrakhan's mostly harmless, right? Think I'm exaggerating? Let's check the record. Adelson has called for nuking the Iranian desert, which supposedly wouldn't hurt a soul, and then nuking Tehran, unless Iran abandons its nuclear weapons program, which of course it doesn't have, although Beinart pretends for a minute that he does. I don't know why he concedes that in the article, when of course it's not true, but anyway. But how does threatening Tehran with nuclear annihilation make Adelson any different than those Iranians who have threatened to destroy Israel? Which, of course, that's really a misquote of Ahmadinejad, too. He never said threaten a first strike there. Anyway, then there's Adelson's view that the Palestinians are, end quote, invented people. Again, flip it around. In 2008, when Tel Aviv University Shlomo Sand published a book called The Invention of the Jewish People, he was widely called anti-Semitic. When Adelson says the same about Palestinians, he's a Republican rock star. This isn't hawkishness, it's hate. Hawks acknowledge that there are divisions among Palestinians, Arabs, and Muslims, but argue that, at this moment in time, the forces of anti-Israel and anti-Semitic militancy have the upper hand. For Adelson, by contrast, there are no distinctions. All Palestinians and all Muslims are detestable killers. It's just who they are. Quote, there isn't a Palestinian alive who wasn't raised on a curriculum of hatred and hostility toward the Jews, he told the Jewish press in 2011. They don't want the Jews or any other religion to be alive, he said in the same interview. The Muslims want to kill 100% of the Jews, he explained last fall. Not all Islamists are terrorists, but all the terrorists are Islamists, he opined in 2012. The ignorance is painful, Beinart writes. At times, Adelson seems to suggest that Palestinians are a religion. They don't want the Jews or any other religion to be alive. His claim that, quote, all the terrorists are Islamists reveals a lack of familiarity with, among others, Timothy McVeigh, Ted Kaczynski, the Ku Klux Klan, the Irish Republican Army, the Tamil Tigers, the Basque National Liberation Movement, the FARC, and the Jewish Defense League. Adelson is on record as admitting that, quote, "I don't know the difference between the Shia and the Sunnis." This is what American democracy has come to. Because billionaires can now spend unlimited sums on political campaigns, he must mean to say here, while preventing regular Americans from combining their money together in ways that they might possibly be able to compete. A primitive old man who knows almost nothing about Palestinians and Muslims except that they are all murderous savages can summon the leading Republican presidential candidates to his casino. Right, these are all the most moral, born-again Christians in our society, these Republicans, to his casino and make them grovel for his affections. Although there were several hundred people in the audience last weekend in Las Vegas, the Washington Post reported that Ohio Governor John Kasich frequently directed his remarks to, quote, Sheldon in his speech, as if he were having a one-on-one chat. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker volunteered that during Hanukkah, he lights a menorah at the governor's mansion. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie urged America to be Israel's unquestioned friend. Then he slipped up by calling the West Bank the Occupied Territories, the same term long used by the United States government, before groveling and offering Adelson a heartfelt apology. Luckily, at times like these, we have John Stewart, who suggested that instead of Occupied Territories, Adelson would have preferred Israel in Waiting or Palestinian Terror Emporium. In watching American Jewish politics today, it's important to be able to laugh. Otherwise, the shame might be too much to bear. That's Peter Beinart at Haaretz.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, y'all. Welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is The Scott Horton Show. So much to talk about, man. We got to still get to torture and all this and that. But here, NATO and Ukraine news. You know what? Here, let me read down a list of headlines for you, and then I'll see which part I want to complain about the loudest from my Ukraine section. NATO plans military buildup in Caucasus Mountains. Poland wants 10,000 NATO troops to, quote, defend from Russia. Latvia, Estonia seek boots on the ground from NATO. U.S. to send more troops to eastern Romania. NATO foreign ministers to meet plan buildup in eastern Europe. Ukraine to host NATO war games, prompting Russian warning. I'm sorry for the alarm in my tone. It's honest. I ain't, you know, trying to sell you nothing. I just, man. And then I love this headline. Just the only reason I save this one for you is because I love the way the headline is written. NATO takes a defiant stance against Russia. Yeah, like Darth Vader took a defiant stance toward Hoth. If that's what you call it. It would be dishonest of you. But yeah, you could. And then, I'll save the good news till the very end, guys. Russian military, quote, buildup greatly exaggerated. Oh, this is good news, too. That's second to last. Ukraine unlocks $27 billion international aid deal. Did someone tell you that there was going to be a $1 billion bailout to Ukraine? Did you hear that? Oh, I heard they're going to give $1 billion. Well, I don't know. Maybe that's not so much. It's enough to make every poor person in your town okay, right? For a year or two. Not that I'm a commie or anything, but Ukraine unlocks $27 billion international aid deal. And they say, oh yeah, the IMF and the EU and whatever. Those are just euphemisms for Americans. American tax victims and American inflation victims. And future ones. $27 billion. And you know what? If that's where they're starting now, just think of what it's going to be by the time this is all over, if it ever ends. $27 billion headed straight for Ukraine. And then this piece by Robert Perry is very important. And I got a grudge against Robert Perry, but damn it, he's right on Ukraine. He's real good on Ukraine. He's at consortiumnews.com. Ukraine's inconvenient neo-Nazis. We can go and read up on Svoboda and the right sector brown shirt thugs. Well, they wear black shirts, I guess, but still. And man, they're mad because their leader, their ROM, was already put up against the wall and shot SS style. They're the SA, get it? And so they're pissed, but they're not all shot yet. But supposedly, they're the government there, which is, after all, run by professional business-level fascists, not brown shirt thugs on the street. They have moved to disarm the right sector thugs who have made themselves the police, really the government, at least, of the capital city. And I don't know how armed they ever really were in the first place. They're somewhat armed, and I don't know who's supposedly going to disarm them. We're not talking about civilians and their guns. We're talking about a bunch of people who are claiming today is someday. And they're not freedom fighters, except in the Carlinian sense. You can tell by their SS lightning bolts and their Heil Hitler 88s and their Iron Crosses and their Waffen SS armbands. It's just incredible, isn't it? It's just absolutely incredible. And it's going to be one of those things where nobody really talks about it. It's kind of a buried, anybody who actually cares enough to know about it knows, but nobody else knows. You know, like Georgia started the war in 08, not Russia, that kind of thing. I don't know if it'll ever become, I guess it very well could become a much bigger deal than it is right now. But America sponsored a coup d'etat that has put Nazis in power. And not just the right sector thugs who've become the police on the streets, but the right sector thugs who have gotten high-level positions in the government now. And the Svoboda thugs, too. And it really is the first time. You know, you think about what a freak-out they had over that guy, Jörg Haider, in Austria back in the 1990s. Remember him? And he was a right-wing ethno-nationalist, and I ain't saying he was a good guy. But, you know, for example, they took him all out of context, right? I don't know if they had anything on him saying anything positive about the Nazi regime at all, other than he was in the middle of an argument with communists, I think avowed communists, and they were calling him Hitler, and in the middle of him attacking their economic policies, which he said had resulted in such a high unemployment rate. And they called him a Nazi, or he called him a Hitler lover or something. And he said, well, Hitler had a better employment policy than you, which, if you're listening, is a slam on their employment policy, not a giant boost of Hitler. In fact, one, and I'm not saying this about Haider because I don't know everything about him, but one could absolutely hate Hitler and think of Hitler as the gold standard of all evil in the whole world and still utter that exact same phrase that, yeah, and your economic policies are even worse than his. And he was a fascist. So what does that tell you? You must be some really lousy, stinky communists to have a worse economic policy than Hitler. But, oh, they went, oh, he said Hitler, and you love Hitler, and they freaked out over that guy. Remember that? Oh, they freaked out. Like he was, you know, the next dictator of Austria, coming to take over the world, start World War III, who knows what. And now here they are. I guess they've been kind of practicing fighting for Al-Qaeda in Libya and Syria, so why not go ahead and prop up a bunch of Nazis in power in Ukraine at this point? What line is there left for the American Empire to cross? You think they'll let us get away with outright doing a pro-Nazi coup in Ukraine? Yeah, what are they going to do about it? Nothing, exactly. I don't know. I mean, what's America supposed to do? 300 million people march on D.C. and tear the whole thing down brick by brick? Put all these people out into the Atlantic on ice floes or something? I don't know. Lou Rockwell had a pretty generous solution to our government problem. He said, let's just pay all these people six-figure salaries for the rest of their lives to go on vacation to the Caribbean. I mean, it would be so much cheaper than the money that they're spending doing what they're doing now. We should just pay them to live in paradise and leave us alone. Now, of course, and I think that Lou would admit that the weakness of his argument is that they won't have enough people to butcher to death down in the Caribbean. They'll need access to, you know, better than a six-figure salary in order to afford the mercenaries and the weapons that they'll need to kill as many innocents as is required to satisfy their thirst for blood. So, I think he'd acknowledge the flaw in his theory there, but anyway, I like the premise behind it. You know, take the entire national government, all of them, every national government employee, and just pay them all six figures to never show up at work again. As far as us protecting ourselves from them after that, you know, the market will take care of it. I wouldn't worry about it. That's my theory. But anyway, so here they are. I mean, you heard what I said about all this buildup. And what that means is, do you have a map of East Europe in your head very good? I know, me either, but, well, Eurasia, it's sort of long and pointy all the way at the western edge there. And then there's a whole big giant Eurasia, and then you get to Alaska, right? Giant blob on the other side of the planet from here. Takes up the whole damn hemisphere. 11, 13 time zones, something like that. Well, that's just Russia, right? It's, what, 25 time zones or something all the way from tip to tip of Eurasia. Anyway, point is, it used to be that the line for you Russians better not cross this line or else you're going to have to tangle with us and including thermonuclear weapons, that line was halfway across Germany. Now, if you're just picturing Europe in your head there, all the way out on the edge, that's Portugal and Spain there. Then comes France, and now, you know, Italy down at the bottom there. But then comes Germany, basically, between the North Sea, the whatever you call it there, and Italy. And then from there on into the Baltics and to Eastern Europe, right? So Germany's just right there to the right of France on your map. At least half of it you could call Western Europe. And anyway, that was the line. And I'm not saying, okay, I justify all Cold War policy or whatever. I'm not too worried that Stalin really wanted to try to conquer Western Europe after all. Anyway, I don't know. Maybe he did. But certainly the guys that came after Stalin never really entertained the possibility of such a thing. But I'm getting to my point, which is that they moved that line where it was in the Ronald Reagan years, halfway across Germany. Don't you cross this line halfway across Germany or I'll nuke you, Reagan said. They moved that line now all the way to Russia's border. If Russia moves their army into the Baltics, if Russia moves their army, I don't know, they have troops stationed in Belarus? I guess, I think they do. I think they have an alliance and troops in Belarus. They cross that frontier into Poland. Or down into Romania and Hungary. What if they want to go take Kosovo back for the Serbs? Then that means America's obligated to go to nuclear war. That's what the NATO alliance means. An attack on any member state is an attack on us all. Oops. Well, I already played that one for you anyway. So They could literally get us into a war over capital cities of countries that you've never even heard of in your life. You've heard of Latvia, but have you ever heard of the capital of Latvia? You might have to trade your hometown for it. And all our government can think to do is double down on all this policy, expand it all more, put more troops, more planes, more provocations in Russia's face. Yeah. All right. Here. On March 7th at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., the Council for the National Interest is co-hosting the first ever national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Confirmed speakers include Walt Scheuer, Giraldi, McGovern, Katowski, Porter, McConnell, Weiss, Raimondo, USS Liberty survivor Ernie Gallo, as well as co-sponsors Alison Ware of If Americans Knew and the great Grant Smith of the Institute for Research, Middle East Policy. That's the national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Friday, March the 7th, all day at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. NatSummit.org. All right, you guys, Sheldon Richman, copycat, my favorite, he's following my path. What I did, I interviewed Gareth Porter 10 times in a row. There's a nice fade there, Horton. I interviewed him 10 times about his book, which is 11 chapters long or something. Anyway, his brand new book, Manufactured Crisis. You can find the link to all 10 of them at scotthorton.org/stress, right there at the top of the page at antiwar.com. And anyway, Sheldon decided that was a good idea. He's going to write a review about each chapter of Gareth's book. So the second one has just come out. It's, what the hell is it called? Oh, man, I don't have it in front of me. Do I? Hell no. Where is it? Anyway, it's at FFF.org. It'll be running at antiwar.com tomorrow. And anyway, so Sheldon Richman, he's a big Gareth Porter fan. And he's going to be reviewing chapter by chapter, summing up Gareth's book for you. You should still buy it. Okay. Manufactured Crisis by Gareth Porter. That's the book. Okay, now check this out. I got to get around to this, don't I? Here's a clip from the new Donald Rumsfeld movie that I think you'll be interested in. Oh, man, don't mess me over now. I knew I should have hit refresh before I even tried. Dumb old thing. Just because it's the future doesn't mean that Flash works well yet.
Osama gets away and a confusion sets in. People began to think that Saddam was connected with al-Qaeda and with 9/11.
Oh, I don't think so. It was very clear that the direct planning for 9/11 was done by Osama bin Laden's people, al-Qaeda, and in Afghanistan. I don't think the American people were confused about that.
In 2003, in a Washington Post poll, 69% said they believe it is likely the Iraqi leader was personally involved in the attacks carried out by al-Qaeda.
I don't remember anyone in the Bush administration saying anything like that, nor do I recall anyone believing that.
Mr. Secretary, today in a broadcast interview, Saddam Hussein said, "There is only one truth. Iraq has no weapons of mass destruction whatsoever." And he went on to say, "I would like to tell you directly, we have no relationship with al-Qaeda."
And Abraham Lincoln was short.
Would you care to respond directly to what Saddam Hussein has said today?
How does one respond to that? It's just a continuous pattern. This is a case of the local liar coming up again and people repeating what he said and forgetting to say that he never, almost never, rarely tells the truth.
You know what? I gotta admit that I give the American people credit. Half of them. And it wasn't just a left-right split either. Half the American people could see through that. Hey, wait a minute. He issued a specific denial. I don't have these weapons. I did not do that attack. I'm not friends with Osama. Come on. Now, the Secretary of Defense, that clip was from February of 2003, right before America launches a war based on the case that these guys have these so-called illegal weapons in defiance of UN resolutions and that they could give them to their friends, Al-Qaeda. And when confronted with a specific denial, I think that's Jim Mikleshensky in the press corps there from NBC News asking the question, maybe. Rumsfeld refuses to make a specific accusation. And, of course, then his answer is just completely ridiculous. The best he could do was Abraham Lincoln was short. Is the Pope Jewish? Does a bear crap in the woods and all of that? That's the best you can do? Donald Rumsfeld? And, of course, he's sort of kind of right. That George Bush, Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell. I think George Tenet. Maybe at one time Tenet might have got it wrong publicly at one time. But they did not go around accusing Iraq of doing 9/11 or even really being tied to Al-Qaeda. Certainly not of doing the 9/11 attacks. On the other hand, Dick Cheney certainly did. And Dick Cheney kept doing it for 2 years after the war. For 3 years after it had already been debunked. I remember it was, I guess it could have been 03, but I think it was 04, September 11th, 04, where Dick Cheney was still saying, yes, Saddam Hussein had met, his head of intelligence had met with Mohammed Atta, the lead hijacker in Prague, in Czechoslovakia, as Dick Cheney called it. Get your lies straight. Czechoslovakia hadn't existed in 10 years, you stupid idiot. In the Czech Republic, that's where Prague is. But anyway, Dick Cheney kept saying that over and over. And the entire neocon network, in and out of government, kept at it over and over and over again. In all of their media. And on TV and in all of their op-eds and whatever. And the what we know this and we know that became the substitute for any evidence whatsoever. Or even any compelling story. It was the CIA and the FBI who debunked the Czech Republic thing. And now it has come out in the last few years where the CIA officer sent to investigate the thing was pissed off. Because he had explicitly debunked the story. The guy in the Czech Republic was not Mohammed Atta, period. And then they kept saying he was after this CIA agent had told headquarters it ain't so. Over and over and over they kept claiming it. Again, not Bush and not Rice and not Powell. Their case was also a lie, but it was a little bit more specific the way they pulled that off. As Colonel Sam Gardner pointed out, he called it the excluded middle technique. And I think excluded middle already has a name for a different kind of thing in a way. But still, I like the name of it. It fits. The excluded middle. Here's how it goes. Ask themselves, this is what George Bush especially would do. He'd ask himself this question. Or someone would ask him. Why do we have to go to war in Iraq? Because of September 11th. Because we learned on September 11th that you can't wait around for someone to start a war against you ever, ever again. You got to start all the wars from now on so that that horror never takes place again here in America. Protect America. Like, didn't the first time. Didn't you notice? But during that silence, that long, pregnant pause, you could have swore what he just said was we have to attack Iraq because of September 11th. He must mean... this president, who's, you know, not the most eloquent of presidents. I think what he was trying to say was Saddam did the attack, right? Because of September 11th, we have to attack Iraq. He's accusing Iraq of doing it, right? But meanwhile, he didn't really say that. You're the one filling in the blank. He's manipulating you and you're being manipulated. The proverbial you, not necessarily specifically you. But then he comes back. And in case you caught on or in case you were wondering, he changes the subject and just says, well, now we have this new doctrine. If there's a threat, we take it out. But now, of course, then a threat is defined as anyone who we don't like, anyone who resists our will, not necessarily someone who is a risk of attacking the United States of America. And anyway, and I've told this story a million times before, but I'll tell it again because it's still meaningful to me. I was a cab driver at the time, and I had this guy in my cab who was some kind of businessman. You could tell he had a high IQ, and I think he was a real estate guy or something. And he was a Republican and an avowed one. And this is before the war. And I was, and he was going, of course, Saddam. And this is just how people are. He was an honest guy, okay? He was a smart guy, and he was an honest guy. And he had already thrown in his lot with he prefers the R's to the D's, okay? And then he's saying to me, of course Saddam did 9/11. Or else, why would we be attacking him? That was all he could do, was rationalize it. You're trying to tell me, kooky cab driver, that America would attack a country that hadn't attacked us? That's crazy. Of course Iraq did it. Now here's a guy who doesn't even watch the news all the time, much less read it all the time, who's just going with his general impression of things. But then, you know me, I got specific objections. Like, hey man, America started bombing Afghanistan. I don't know why it took them 3 or 4 weeks there. But anyway, eventually they pretty much started bombing Afghanistan, changed the government, killed a lot of Al-Qaeda guys, if not Osama. But now they're going through this whole rigmarole for a year and a half, or 2 years, or a year and a half, and going to the United Nations and asking France and Russia and China for permission. Does that sound to you like it's a direct response to an attack on this country? You're telling me the United States of America is going to sit around with a limp one in our hand, waiting around for permission from the French to avenge an actual attack on this country by the government of any other country on this planet other than Saudi Arabia? Forget it. There's no way. It couldn't possibly be the answer. And then I told him, go in and Google it, man. Look up Condoleezza Rice, Iraq 9/11. Look up Colin Powell. Look up all of these top-level guys and see that they're not really saying Saddam did it. They're saying that they're pretending that they think that someday he might help Al-Qaeda with something else, based on bogus ties that are not even believable and have never been proven. They knew they were lying this whole time. They were very happy to leave everyone with the impression that Iraq was behind the 9/11 attacks. In fact, Dick Cheney, you could tell what knowing liars these guys are when they use weasel words like this. When Dick Cheney refers to Iraq as the geographical center of where these attacks against us originate. Was he sort of kind of referring to the American bases on the Holy Arabian Peninsula that were there to be used to bomb and blockade Iraq in the 1990s during the entire Bush Sr. and Bill Clinton years to strangle a million people to death, including 500,000 children? Which was a major reason invoked by Al-Qaeda through the whole entire 1990s for the war, their war against us, that they said we started. Is that what he meant? That 9/11 was waged in part to avenge what America had done to Iraq, even if not by any Iraqis at all? Bastards. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org. Hey, I'm Scott. This is my show. Welcome back to the show. Oh, I should have been, making money this whole time teasing. Later on the show, the truth about Benghazi. Or does that make y'all want to change the channel? Like, it makes me want to change the channel when I hear this crap. Well, I do have something to say about it here in a minute, but don't worry, it won't be the same old thing you already heard, I don't think. And maybe it is. Anyway, first I want to talk a little bit about this thing at the Liberty Crier this morning. Trevor Lyman of the Liberty Crier. Man, he does a good job keeping track of police state issues. And they got this documentary. It's actually a TED Talk, a video of a TED Talk of a doctor talking about how he is treating children with severe grand mal seizure epilepsy in Colorado, where it's legal. He's treating them with extracts of marijuana plants. And it's not the THC that does it at all. It's an entirely different compound in the cannabis that's getting the job done. And how they've even bred a strain of pot that has virtually no THC in it at all, since that's not what they're using, and apparently it doesn't need to be in combination with it or anything else. So they've bred a strain of weed that won't get you high, and they're using it to treat these children, and it's saving their lives. And these, I don't know if you've ever known anybody with epilepsy. It depends on the situation. But they're in this case, they're focusing specifically on this one little girl. She was dying of this thing. She was having hundreds of seizures a week. Hundreds of them. Any skills she ever learned, like feeding herself or walking around or learning to talk or any kind of thing, all that was being lost. She was dying. And the doctors were saying, she's dying. I'm sorry. Like, they had to cut a hole in her stomach to feed her at all and this kind of thing. Craziness. And there's nothing else to do. Except then these doctors, the parents found out, or the doctors found out about her or something. Somehow they found out the kid's being treated with cannabis extracts, and she's down to one seizure a week. And much less intensity. And she's now finally show her tap dancing and whatever. She's now catching up with her twin sister and is now doing much better in this and that. And then they talked about how there are other kids who were actually who they know about, these doctors. It's a doctor giving a TED Talk. Again, he's talking about children that they knew that they were trying to arrange to bring these children to Colorado so that they could treat them. And at least one of the kids died before his parents could get him there. Which, like, I don't know where you are, how much money you don't have, but man, you can get to Colorado from anywhere in a few hours, dude. But it didn't work, and this kid died. And one little thing that he showed, quick slide, and then he said, don't want to change the subject, but just so you know, blam, here's some medical research from the 1940s, where they say marijuana leaf effective for treating seizures in epileptics. And then, of course, this research was buried because of the war on pot users. Can you imagine that? Of course you can. If you're a libertarian at all, then you know. Yeah. Oh, yeah, these are the same guys that tested germ weapons in the subways in New York, right, Scott? Right. That's right. They're the same guys who went to war against the Nazis just to become them. And they would bury the fact that epileptics could be treated with pot for decades, for generations. Because letting them suffer and letting them die would be better than letting them get high. Oh, you don't want to send the wrong message to the children. We know what the right message is. The right message is, you're better off dead, according to some terrified Republican wife. Oh, no, but what if Johnny smokes pot? Yeah, maybe you need to take care of your own business and leave everybody else alone. How could it be? I mean, this doctor says, and he should be willing to risk prison for this. Come on, man, when the kid's dying? He said, I can't ship the pot to this family, even to save their kid's life. It's a crime. I'll be a drug trafficker and go to prison, which, you know, that's understandable. He's got a family he's got to take care of, whatever. But the politicians, the consensus, no matter what the people think, no matter what the doctors and the parents beg, they don't care at all. They don't care at all. They would just as soon see this little 3-year-old girl die of unending epileptic seizures to death. That's not much worse than being interrogated by the CIA, right, guys? And takes a few eggs to make an omelet and you gotta break them wide open, don't you? In order to have a perfect pot-free society. But no, these doctors, these parents are felons in any state in the union except Colorado and Washington State. I mean, even where they have medical pot, it's not okay for kids, right? And the rest of the medical pot states? I don't know all the details. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Hell. But still, even the medical pot states are less than half of the states in the union. Anyway, it just goes to show you that the government, they don't care about you. That's not why they're here, and they never were. And everything they say about how they're here to protect you is just not true at all. And even if it was, these are the kinds of value judgments they make. That they would rather your kid die than benefit from a medicine that someone else might get the wrong message from, that it's okay for them to do. Can you imagine that? That's what they call calculus. And then the objector says, I don't know, guys. Are you sure about the optics of this? That means how this will look in English. To a politician, it's optics. Newspeak, American newspeak. What are the optics of our calculus? That it's better to let a kid die than take a medicine. Oh, that doesn't even get him high. It's just, you know, somewhat genetically related to the same strand of plant that might. And whether that's sending the right message or not. I can see why some people believe our entire planet, or at least our society, is run by evil, you know, baby cannibalizing, bloodthirsty, satanic killers or something, because that sure is how they behave, right? They must have some kind of religion or another that justifies what they do to people. Anyway, if your kid has some terrible life-threatening epilepsy, move to Colorado and give it a try. I don't know. I'm not a doctor. I don't know if it'll apply in your case. But don't let Republicans and Democrats stop you from putting your family first. It's madness. That's LibertyCrier.com. Go and watch the TED Talk of this guy and watch the little girl. She comes out and says hi to the audience and everything. She's doing better now. Anyway, good. I'm glad I talked all the way up to almost the very end of the show. That way I can't go on too long about this Benghazi thing. Let me just go down my list here real quick of things to say about Benghazi. James Bovard, in watching the Waco hearings, said, watching the Republicans and the Democrats at the Waco hearings back in the 1990s, he said, it was like watching drunks fight in a bar. They swing and they miss. Nobody's ever better than half right about anything in Washington, D.C. It's ridiculous. The best you ever get out of them is when they're accusing each other, and then they can't even get that right. At all. So here, it turns out they lied about all the warnings that they had. And the excuse is, well, the CIA's excuse for lying is, well, we didn't want to make the State Department look bad. Because, yes, in fact, we had warned them and they didn't take good enough precautions. But it was too soon to come out with that accusation. We would be impolite as bureaucrats. Something like that was his excuse. I saw him on Fox TV today. Morrell, who was the acting head of the CIA at the time. And then The other thing is about, well, a few other things here. One of them is, I told you this before too, that I think Rachel Maddow still has the best case. I'm sure she changed her answer because it doesn't fit with what the Obama administration wants everybody to say. But she had an initial take on this that I guess she didn't clear with the White House first, or at least she talked to the wrong person on the NSC or whatever before she went on the air with it. And I think she was basically right. That, remember the guy I told you about yesterday, and you already know, a guy, I think he was a sheikh of some kind, whatever that means, Sheikh Al-Libi, and Dick Cheney had him tortured into implicate by the Egyptian sock puppet dictatorship into implicating Saddam Hussein in teaching Al-Qaeda how to hijack planes and how to make chemical weapons. Well, and then had Gaddafi murder him in his cell and call it a suicide back before they stabbed Gaddafi in the back. Well, anyway, his brother, you know, Al-Libi means, you know, the guy from Libya. His brother was killed in a CIA drone strike in Pakistan in June of 2012. And Ayman al-Zawahiri had put out a podcast saying, hey, wouldn't it be a good idea, you Libyans, who have the Americans surrounded there in eastern Libya, to avenge the death of our brother-in-arms, Al-Libi's brother, Sheikh Yahya Al-Libi. And that podcast came out just a few weeks before the September 11th attacks. And then I think he also, of course, you know, referenced September 11th in there, too. And so then they showed up on September 11th and they got their dirty work done. And, of course, my point about they're drunk and they swing and they miss, the Republicans are completely missing the point that the Americans, with Republican support, the Obama administration, fought a war for the Mujahideen and stationed their guys in the Mujahideen's part of town, the town being the entire nation of Libya, in eastern Libya there, where all the veterans of the Iraq War lived, the Ansar al-Sharia and the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, etc. They were funneling guns to Syria, and it blew up in their face. They don't want to talk about any of that, that the war was fought for the bad guys in the first place, you damn Republicans, which is the same as fools.